Support for The Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette Mail, with two dueling editorial pages representing a conservative and liberal viewpoint, kind of like The Front Porch. Check it out at wvgazettemail.com. And you're on The Front Porch. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and I'm joined by Rick Wilson. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And Lori Lynn.
Hi, Scott.
And guest.
I have my son Charlie with us again today. I'm trying to keep him quiet with graham crackers, but if you hear some grunting, that's probably Charlie.
Hey, Charlie.
I'd just like to say Lori felt obliged to one-up me this time
I
had a dog in here last time. I think I'll have to bring in a peacock or a goat next time.
I think your dog might have been cuter than my baby.
I don't know.
Well, today, Charlie's going to help us look back on 2016 and forward to 2017. Rick, what is one big issue that you're going to be looking at in the coming year?
Well, I think one thing that we're going to have to look at real soon is what happens to the Affordable Care Act. Are they going to repeal it and just cut off 20 or 30 million people from health care? Are they going to throw 225,000 West Virginians under the bus, or are they going to replace it? And I'm hoping that they don't just get rid of something without replacing it.
And you asked Senator Capito about that when she was in here, and she said, look, it's going to be repealed. So assuming that, what do you think, what are you going to be advocating that the Republican Congress do?
Least possible harm.
By
finding some way to preserve coverage for people who gained it through especially Medicaid expansion. And, you know, there are people who bought it on the exchange or marketplace. What's going to happen with them? There really is quite a few people when you look at it. And we've had one of the biggest drops in the uninsured rate, too.
Vice President-elect Pence, they got a Medicaid waiver that asked people on Medicaid to do things like paying a copay or premium support, like a dollar a month sometimes, just so they could be said to be buying into it. How do you feel about those sorts of programs?
I think that would be better than replacing it outright. I think in Kentucky, though, they've gone after an approach that's more punitive, just designed to get people not to use it at all. So, you know, it's going to be in the details.
All right. We'll be looking out for that. Charlie is going to be checking out, I think, the graham cracker scene in the next coming year.
And the apple juice supply.
Speaking of children, Lori, you said you're going to be looking out for education issues in the legislature this year.
Yeah, so charter schools is the one thing that I personally would love to see a charter school bill come out of the state legislature. It's been tried many, many times. It's had support on both sides of the aisle. It's just that, you know, the teacher unions have been so adamantly against it. It hasn't gotten done. I think this could be the year. So fingers crossed, we will see.
What does a charter school bill look like in West Virginia with a lot of rural areas and that sort of thing?
The last time they wanted to do two charter schools a year, I think for 5 years maybe, so they would have ended up with a total of like 10 charter schools. And, you know, it would have been an experiment. You know, something like that obviously is not going to change very many lives. You're talking about two schools per year. But it would have been an opportunity to try something new. And that's something that our state education establishment has just been so adamantly opposed to. Any kind of experimentation, any kind of tinkering around, any kind of choice, you know, getting away from a one-size-fits-all model. It's not something that's going to, you know, overnight transform West Virginia public education. But 43 states have charter school bills. This is not some kind of crazy, whacked out, you know, avant-garde thing. I don't see why we can't try it. Other states have had success with it. Some states have not had success with it. But I think it's worth giving it a try, especially when we're talking about a very small scale.
So we'll see if that happens. It hasn't happened yet, but then again, you got a new governor. Though I'm not sure where justice stands on this stuff. You definitely have new leadership in the legislature who may have more time on their hands to deal with education issues because they're done with some of their other bread and butter economic issues like right to work.
And like I said, it's bipartisan. I think former Senator Eric Wells, for example, is a big Democrat, big proponent of charter schools. It's not a one, you know, monolithic party issue. So I think, like you said, that they will have some time on their hands. We got right to work and prevailing wage repeal done last time. I think this is kind of a low-hanging fruit left.
It'll be interesting to see what happens. I lived in Florida, and I also worked for a news organization down there that did a lot of coverage of charter schools in Florida. And the truth of the matter is, it's not a panacea. But it's not this evil thing either. It depends on the school. It depends on how it's set up. It depends on the oversight. I mean, there's a lot of factors go into whether or not it's a successful thing or not.
And a lot of the successes, to be frank, have been in very urban areas. That's where charter schools have really shown some big gains. New Orleans, Washington, D.C. And so that is not naturally the best fit for West Virginia, maybe. But we do have urban areas here. So, you know, it's not like completely out of left field. So, yeah, I think it will be interesting to see.
There's already legislation that was passed that would enable places to do a lot like charter schools. I think they call it innovation, something or another. I'll look up. I mean, there's already some existing thing without going down the charter school route where you could do a lot of that.
Within the public school system as opposed to having an independent, let's say, board or nonprofit set up its own school.
Yeah, and I think the risk of it is, you know, sort of undermining public education, siphoning off probably the wealthy, more successful kids, leaving public schools to handle the more difficult ones and then saying, see, they're not doing their job. And there's not a lot of accountability and the record's not always that impressive.
So, I have one thing that I'm looking forward to. 2016 might be the year that we all kind of woke up to what social media was doing to our lives, the spread of fake news on all sides, people with confirmation biases not looking at the other side of issues. If nothing else, this election season, I think, has exposed all of that. And now you're seeing a really interesting trend where, for example, the Washington Post is hiring new reporters, and they're bragging about how profitable they are in Politico. New York Times is expanding. Every time that Trump tweets attacking a media outlet, the media outlet has a whole bunch of new subscribers. Donald Trump, please attack the front porch right away. We could use it. It's heartening. It says to me that people are kind of looking around and saying, wait a second, you know, journalism matters. There's still other folks that are fighting against that sort of thing, but I think it's been a real awakening for folks about the need for fact-based journalism.
The Greek word apocalypse literally means to uncover that which is concealed.
So you're saying the media is the apocalypse?
How would you define fake news,
apocalyptic media. I like it.
How would you define fake news?
Things that are completely not true. Like the kids in Macedonia who are making up stories from whole cloth just to make money. That's fake news. Now, there's news that's slanted very heavily and very partisan, and I think that's fine for it to be out there, but I think that, you know, my brother's an English teacher, and they're spending a lot of time now not teaching kids how to look things up, but teaching kids how to make judgments about what they're reading. I think we have to be a lot more critical in what we read. Lori Lynn, what would you say is the most important, the biggest story of 2016?
Well, this is not controversial, I think, but just what happened the night of, you know, election night 2016, 7 o'clock, everyone who was anyone thought that we were going to have President-elect Hillary Clinton. And then by the wee hours of the morning, it became clear that that was in fact not going to happen. I mean, I think the Donald Trump not only winning the Republican nomination, which is pretty surprising to a lot of people, but the presidency is a real political earthquake. Yeah, I'm not sure how you top that as a story.
And we still don't know how it's all going to shake out. It's like we're still in the middle of it. What does it mean for the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, for constitutional and democratic norms? I think these things are still being figured out. We're in the middle of it right now.
No, I think absolutely. I mean, that's why I would say earthquake. You know, I mean, he's not even really a Republican. What does that mean for the Republican Party?
Also,
the Democrats lost Pennsylvania for the first time in a generation. What does that mean for them?
Also, are we going to have to change the spelling of China from CH to J? China, you know, I mean, a lot of things are in play right now.
The new White House and Trump Tower.
Yeah.
All right. Well, my biggest story of 2016 is an ongoing story. It's for West Virginia, and it would be the ongoing opioid crisis. And the fact that it just keeps morphing. What started out as pain pills is turned into heroin, and now is turning into something called fentanyl, which is a synthetic opioid. We had that spectacle in Huntington. Do you remember when we had all these overdoses happening in a 48-hour period? But it's also the year that people really started to recognize this on a national level. You know, we had Eric Ayer on here from the Charleston Gazette Mail talking about the people that are prescribing these things in large numbers and getting national attention for that. We also had David and Dyke Grubb, who are friends of mine, who spoke with President Obama when he came here to talk about the opioid crisis, about their daughter who died of an overdose. And just recently, you know, that one bipartisan bill that passed out of the lame duck session that had money for opioid treatment? David and Dyett were there, and David actually introduced the president when that bill signing took place. That's how much of an impact that they had. I think it's the biggest health crisis the state has seen, maybe ever, and that's not good, but there's some, at least people are paying attention to it on a national level. So that's my big story of the year. Rick, what's your big story of 2016?
Well, just in West Virginia terms, I think the flood, the storms that hit. I mean, I live in a place where weather matters, but, you know, it did a lot of damage, took quite a few lives in this state, and it's got a lot of people looking up at the sky and wondering what's next.
And you know, nice thing about the floods, I think I've heard from a lot of people that came in from the outside who were shocked at how West Virginians really helped each other out. The volunteer spirit, the number of folks that mucked out houses, helped rebuild, that's special. You know, I've heard that over and over again, that folks were surprised at the level of community and volunteerism here. And
the tiny house thing was cute too, I think. Sorry.
The attention has been really ongoing. That's what's impressed me. It wasn't just this, you know, 3-week story where people paid attention for a while. There have been, you know, continued focus on these communities rebuilding, the businesses rebuilding, getting people back into their homes or new homes. You know, it happened in June, and it's still really an ongoing thing that people are paying attention to.
All right, we're trying to end on a positive note. Hard for us to do, but we're going to try to do it. Lori, what would you say would be a positive story that you've noticed in the last year?
Well, white working class voters were the soccer moms of this election. That phrase, white working class, was on everyone's lips. And, you know, for a state that really is, you don't get much whiter or more working class than West Virginia, that can't be a bad thing to have not only the nation and the media focused on people like West Virginians, but the Democratic Party, frankly, which I think had kind of written people like that off, thought, hey, we don't need them, they're not the future. I think that, you know, they're revisiting that assumption based on what happened in November.
Rick, what's your positive story of the year?
Well, I think people are trying to really pursue economic alternatives in the coal fields. There's programs like the Coalfield Development Corporation, Refresh West Virginia. There's efforts to do more agriculture, fish farming, things like that. And I mean, it would be nice to think we've hit bottom. That would actually be a positive thing at this point.
And I'm going to riff off of that too, is I think, you know, maybe it's with Trump's election, maybe it's just passage of time. I think that the war on coal can officially be called over. And at that point, once that happens, and the focus shifts now to not to what a president does and what the EPA does, but more and more to what's happening with the economy and these changes that are bigger than that, it allows people to start having, I think, better conversations about how we have to diversify and how we move forward from here.
Have you noticed that, you know, after the election now, a lot of people who were screaming about the war on coal are saying now we shouldn't expect too much to come back. It's probably not going to, they're trying to lower expectations after it accomplished its main objective, which was political.
Yeah, but you're also seeing the other side. I mean, you're seeing some people acknowledging that, oh, yeah, well, actually, maybe the regulatory stuff did have some effect. We might see a little rebound. So I think that goes both ways.
All right. Rick, do you have a Bible verse for us this week?
It's from the letter to the Hebrews.
It's hopeful, right? It's a hopeful.
It's about hope, yeah. Okay. It's what Emily Dickinson called the thing with feathers. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I would probably emphasize things not seen, but that's just how I roll.
Evidence, fact-based.
That's King James. Yeah.
Even the Bible demands evidence-based reporting.
Of course, then there's Lou Reed, who said you need a busload of faith to get by, which I think is true these days.
All right, well, that's the Front Porch for this week. This is Scott Finn, Executive Director, with Charlie and Lori Lynn and Rick Wilson. Thanks for joining us.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.